KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Wow. What an exciting special guest. That was Hillary Clinton's husband. Oh, my God. That was exciting.
We're seeing a lot of hullabaloo, but I think it's going to be similar to what we've seen in the past. It's just more formalized that the conservatives in the Senate are in control.
Julia, Tina, Amy, and Zoe have respectively gotten me through middle school, mono, a ruptured eardrum, and the acute floating anxiety that populates my entire life.
And now my question is, was Josh Feit talking about the Golden Globes in that clip, or was he talking about the legislature? Because he's going to join us to talk about the legislature. That was Lena Dunham, that last voice you heard. She was winner of the Best Actress for her show Girls, which also won Best Comedy when she was accepting her award at the Golden Globes. And Amy Poehler, one of the hosts of the Golden Globes, talking about Bill Clinton. An excuse to talk to Melanie McFarland again about the television aspect of the Golden Globes. And overall, the Golden Globes? What are they? We're going to take that up in a few minutes. But first, we're going to take a look at what's happening in the state legislature. As you know, today marks the start of Washington State's 2013 regular session for the legislature. Lawmakers are all talking about education as their top priority. How they're going to fund it and how they're going to measure student success is a big topic. So is Jay Inslee's new job and what he's going to do. Publicola's founder and editor-in-chief, Josh Feit, has a preview, and he likes going down to the legislature. So I asked him, what happens on the first day? What's it like?
I mean, everybody is it's like the first day of school. Everybody's shiny and got their fresh notebooks and is ready to go. And everybody's talking about bipartisanship on the first day. Of course, and it's a lot of pop and circumstance and just swearing in. And of course, bipartisanship has already gotten a lot of play in the past month as this majority coalition caucus is talking like they're bipartisan. Of course, the Democrats have completely disputed that. So I think bipartisanship might already be out the window as we get started.
Now, here we are and of course that starts in the Senate. What has been determined at this point about who is going to chair committees and who is going to hold the gavel?
Right. So basically, that's still in terms of who's going to chair committees. That's a great question, and it's in flux, and it's a key question because if some Democratic senators who are now in the minority take up Senator Rodney Thom's offer to chair committees, that will add to the credibility of his so-called bipartisan majority coalition caucus. What has to happen today before that's decided is. Or officially decided is they have to do some rule changes to make Thom the Senate Majority Leader and his coalition in charge. But they simply have to change a rule so that leaders and caucuses don't have to be identified with a party at the ballot, but can be identified by people that are agreed to caucus and vote together.
And all that's in place. There's no some last-minute surprise move by the Democrats.
I don't think so. I think what I've been hearing from the Democratic side is they understand that this is going to happen and they're outnumbered. You know, they might give some fancy speeches on the floor, but I think, you know, they're outgunned and the Republicans and Thom, a wayward Democrat, renegade Democrat, whatever you will, is going to make that happen. I think everyone assumes that's a done deal.
All right,
but
now,
it will happen on the floor today.
Now, one thing you were writing about, Josh Feit, founder and editor of Publicola, one thing you're writing about is that some of the Democrats are looking at Rodney Thom's proposal, gives the Republicans many more members, disproportionate advantage on some of these powerful committees, rules and ways and means. How does that happen?
That's right. So there's with all of Senator Thom's talk of bipartisanship, there's an irony here, which is that when the Democrats first made their offer back in November, based on when they had, you know, this slim 26-23 advantage, they thought they divide up the committees with just one vote lead for the Democrats in each committee, and then also they had a bipartisan committee to deal with K-12 funding specifically. The Republicans, or the Majority Coalition Caucus, as they're being called, has a counteroffer that they say is more bipartisan, but in fact, they've stacked the committee so that in really powerful and important committees like Rules, 12-7 Advantage, Ways and Means, which obviously deals with the budget, 13-10 Advantage, and even in some of these committees where they, and in Energy, actually, a 3-1 Advantage, which is a key slap at the Democrats, because this is where new Democrat-elect Governor Jay Inslee wants to move his environmental agenda, and that's going to have no chance of getting anywhere with that stacked against the Democrats. But then the Republicans are trying to have some co-chaired committees to have a veneer of partisanship. However, when you look at some of those committees, for example, if Steve Hobbs, a conservative Democrat, takes over financial institutions, he's a conservative Democrat, so it's not clear the Democrats will have control, even though his number will put them in a nominal advantage. And similarly, in the Transportation Committee, if Senator Ide, a Democrat, takes up Tom on his offer to chair that committee, co-chair that committee with the Republicans, the numbers will be, 9-7 Republican or Majority Coalition Caucus advantage. So you have to look at the numbers of the committee makeup, not just who's chairing.
So, Josh, it sounds like a little bit of a recipe for gridlock or maybe compromise. Well, it depends. I mean, we have the House staunchly run by Frank Chop, and you have a newly Democratic governor in Jay Inslee. How do people think the shape of this legislative session is going to go?
Well, I think what you're going to see is, in terms of the budget, I think it's going to be very similar to what you've seen in the last couple of years. These are not new numbers. You had a Democratic governor last couple of times during the recession. We're talking about these recessionary era budgets. And again, they had the liberal House with Frank Chop in control. And the numbers on the Senate side are pretty much the same. So what you saw two sessions ago is Ed Murray hammering out a pretty bipartisan deal on the budget. Last year, again, the Republicans actually had a coup and took over the budget briefly, and they cut education. The Democrats were able to come back in with the House backing them up and get that education money back in. So I think you're going to see we're seeing a lot of hullabaloo, but I think it's going to be similar to what we've seen in the past. It's just more formalized that the conservatives in the Senate are in control. I mean, again, they had a coup last year during the budget process, so we all saw this coming. In terms of social issues, you know, the Rodney Tom and the Republicans have said, hey, we're not rolling the clock back on social issues. But that's not the question. The question is, can the Democrats, after this 2012 election, when Democrats won handily at the state level, up and down the ballot, can they move forward on the Democratic agenda? Things like voting rights, things like gun control, things like the Reproductive Parity Act. These are things that are moving forward. And what you're going to see is the Senate, now that Tom's given it over control to the Republicans, is that's going to stall that Democratic agenda on social issues.
Josh Feit is founder and editor of Publicola. He's covering the legislature. The legislative session starts today with much pomp and circumstance and new notebooks, as he said, at 12:30. Well, what's Jay Inslee's approach here? Any sense of what's happening with him?
You know, the interesting thing about Inslee is, in part to get elected, he talked like an economic conservative. No new taxes. He even really slammed down a Democratic idea to fund K-12 education that came from the liberal House, which is the levy swap, to have the state take over local property taxes and redistribute it more evenly. And he also then accused Rob McKenna, his Republican opponent, of backing new taxes, so kind of a reverse there. So in some sense, and Tom's coalition caucus has said this, they think he's in line with them, you know, but again, I think he's not in line with them on environmental issues and social issues, which are going to play out in the Senate and stall that agenda. The thing I think that's exciting about Jay Inslee that's different than what you've seen in the past is this guy has a history of being a legislator. He's going to be hands-on. He thinks big. So I think he's going to be in the wings. He's going to be out there kind of pushing his agenda much more aggressively than you've seen past governors. So frankly, as a reporter, it's going to be much more exciting to cover to see an active executive office.
That's interesting, that note about him being a former legislator. That's a good point. Say, The levy swap, was it going to raise an enormous amount of money, enough to cover the money that they say they need to fully fund education, amply fund education?
This is a real debate, and so everyone has it's a confusing debate. It's a tough issue. A lot of people have different opinions on this. The state, the proposal by Ross Hunter on the House, the state would have put an extra money on the state books. So they could have taken in another billion that wouldn't have been new money per se, but because the local districts were already covering that. But the Supreme Court said that the local districts shouldn't be doing that, and the state had to pick that up. So frankly, yes, despite accusations that it was just a budgeting gimmick, I think there was some legitimacy to the point that it would have put the state, it would have made the state more responsible, more accountable, and in fact, it would have made a more stabilized funding mechanism. That plan, though, got a lot of resistance, ironically, from liberals in Seattle who felt like the tax burden would have increased in richer districts like Seattle, like the East Side, and so it was seen as being unfair, and I think leaders like Frank Schaap would not go for it. Leaders like Ed Murray from Seattle were not going for it. So Hunter, I think, had to back off. You'll notice that he was the Ways and Means chair. That committee was divided. He's now been called the Appropriations chair, and they created a new committee, Finance, given it to State Rep. Reuben Carlisle from Seattle, who is well known for his animosity or his questioning of the tax structure that has Seattle sending out more money than it gets back. So I think you're seeing the levy swap idea shot down. Frankly, I think it's a little hypocritical for Seattleites who are for progressive taxation, for redistribution of wealth, to have come out against that so strongly.
Well, Josh Feit, the question then is, do they need new money for education, as Democrats have talked about, many people have talked about, or is there enough money in the system, like Steve Lietzow is going to be running an education committee in the Republican-run Senate? Is there enough money there, and they just need to rejigger it and do other policies?
They need to find new revenue. Whether it be the levy swap or whatever, or new taxes, they need to find new revenue. The McCleary decision from the Supreme Court came down and said they were not funding education. The nonpartisan staff committees have figured they need at least $1 billion in new money over the next biennium. And the irony, or what's wrong with what Steve Lietzow is saying, Steve Lietzow, of course, is the Republican who is now going to be the K-12 education chair. The irony there is he's a big education reformer. And the McCleary decision was based on legislation that was passed a couple years ago that Lietzow was into, that basically redefined basic education. Here's what we have to do to be up to speed. The Supreme Court used that decision, and that's what the money number is based on. So these are things that Steve Lietzow supposedly supports, these kind of education reform ideas that he supposedly supports, and they require, according to his own Senate nonpartisan staff, at least $1 billion in new dollars. So for him to be saying that they can just rejigger the system does not hold, and is a little hypocritical given that he's an ed reformer, and the Supreme Court case McCleary decision was based on an education reform bill that he'd helped pass.
Well, a lot of people are saying, look, let's just keep status quo on the other parts of the budget. It's going to grow anyways, given inflation and a little bit of an improved economy. And then we shift the most of that new money that will be coming in through growth, we put that into education.
Yeah, I mean, that is what Rob McKenna was saying during the election. He, put his 6% cap on any spending above what was coming in from new revenue would go to directly to education. You talk to someone like Rep. Ross Hunter, who, again, appropriation chair, and he says that's impossible. We need new taxes. We're going to end up cutting social services. If we do it, it's a disaster. Governor Greg Warren said the same thing, and you're going to see her tomorrow give her farewell address in which she's likely to once again make a pitch for new taxes. She's going to call for some beer taxes, oil taxes, extension of B&O surcharge taxes that she thinks are necessary. I mean, she's been through this recessionary cycle now since 2009 and has seen the cuts and cuts and cuts. So given the $900 million shortfall right now just to meet the budget requirements, given the $1 billion just to meet the McCleary decision, I think you're going to see people saying we can't do that without finding new revenue.
Josh, the president is held a press conference talking about gun control. Tomorrow he's going to hear from Joseph Biden and his recommendations. At the local level, at the legislative level, any talk about gun control, any talk about automatic weapons, high-powered ammunition or magazines being controlled?
You know, there's a lot of talk, about, obviously, in the wake of Newtown, a lot of talk, and this has been an issue for liberals in the legislature for a long time, but they have pretty much resigned to the fact that even given their own Democratic caucus, which is conservative on gun control issues, that they can't get sweeping change. I talked with Judiciary Chair Rep. Jamie Peterson, a liberal from Seattle, and even though he says he supports personally things like the gun show loophole, closing that he's not going to get that, and there's going to be some tweaks like increasing penalties for juveniles in possession of firearms, and also sort of doing and maybe checking. That's the main one I can think of. In fact, there was gun control legislation that was actually pulled back on. Liberal representative was going to respond to what happened with a stand down law, and she actually backed off on that. So it seems to me that gun control, even though it's hyped and is an issue for liberals, that it doesn't have much traction this session.
Well, maybe we'll see a surprising coalition of NRA lobbyists and mental health advocates finding new money for improving the mental health system.
Okay.
All right, what's your favorite part of covering the legislature as it starts? What do you like the best?
What do I like the best? I mean, what I like to see is, and this is what makes this year so exciting, you know, is these moving coalitions and these factions. And it's really going to be interesting to see if the Republicans, who took a drubbing in the last election, basically on the extreme conservatism, all this hyper rhetoric around rape and around choice, if they got the message, and will they sort of change their tune and sort of focus on where they have a strength in this state, which seems to be on economic issues and fiscal conservatism? And I'll tell you, it seems like they did get the message, because if you look at the leaders that they're putting in place with this majority coalition caucus, it's what you call the Bellevue Republicans. These are the Republicans at some, you know, which is the old term for maybe rhinos. So sort of more moderate Republicans from the Microsoft suburbs stepping up, as opposed to the ideologues from Eastern Washington in leadership positions. For example, Andy Hill is going to be in charge of Ways and Means. And he, Lipsow, a pro-choice Republican, going to be in charge of education. Rodney Tom himself, a social liberal Senate majority leader. So the interesting thing here is watching a sea change in the Republicans who might be second-guessing their hardline rhetoric. That remains to be seen. Of course, the risk here is that Tom has empowered Eastern Washington Republicans, and we might see them dash their whole chance at leadership. I mean, that's the thing. Now that the spotlight is on the Republicans, they might just blow it and show that they aren't moderate, aren't bipartisan, and do have an ideological agenda. You saw that last year with their Senate budget coup, when they always talk about funding education, got control for a day and didn't fund education.
That's Josh Feit. He's the co-founder and editor of Publicola. He is covering the legislature. We'll talk to him again. The legislature gets underway, I think, in about 2 hours with pomp and circumstance. I think there's even, they pass out the notebooks and then everybody goes to the cafeteria. This is Weekday.
Well, from Washington state politics, later today we're going to go in-depth on a political issue in Canada. First Nations across Canada are protesting government measures they say undermine Native sovereignty and degrade the environment. A chief is on hunger strike, and flash mobs are popping up to support the movement known as Idle No More. Native American environmental activist Winona LaDuke joins us to talk about all that tonight at 10:20 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Foster Pepper, providing business and regulatory legal counsel to all types of banks and financial institutions throughout the region. Online at foster.com and on Twitter. When it happens, Foster Pepper is there.
It's 35 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Our forecast says we're not going to see much change for the rest of the day. It's supposed to be cloudy all day with a high of just 36. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:24. President Obama on gun control in the news at 11.
Now we're going to turn to the Golden Globes because I'm just curious about the Golden Globes. And Melanie McFarland, who has to cover the Golden Globes as her job as TV editor of IMDb, we just thought we'd ask you in to talk about it. Because I thought the Golden Globes were just a bunch of foreign news people who sat around California and then handed out awards to like Pia Zadora, you mentioned, and other people. The Golden Globes has actually become a real and important award show for people who like to get awards.
Well, the thing about it is the Golden Globes for many years has been one of those telecasts that you watch both for the kind of easy craziness of it because everyone's drinking, but it really does, for such a long time, it kind of is the game setter for the Academy Awards, because many times the Best Picture nominees have crossed over to the main Academy Awards nominees.
But that's not the case in TV.
That's not the case in TV, because remember, the Emmys ran in September. So the Globes are interesting because they come in mid-season for television. So there are many nominees that have only been in existence for half a season in terms of TV series, I mean. So you'll have performances that are nominated and sometimes even win, even though the show has only been on for half a season.
Who votes in the Golden Globes?
It's the members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. And it's a relatively small body, which is why you see some kind of wackadoodle choices in TV.
Why did we pay attention to that? Why does it matter? I mean, I understand it matters because movie stars and TV stars are on stage, and so that's always fun, and they're in nice gowns. But does
it's very
it,
glamorous.
Yes. Does it help people get jobs? Does it tell something about the culture where it stands today?
I think for television in particular, it is a lovely prestige award, and there have been many instances where there have been performances that would have never have been recognized before. That can be both a good thing and a bad thing.
Why a bad thing? You recognize somebody?
Well, if you're not necessarily for the winners, but you might have, say, Jennifer Love Hewitt getting a Globe nomination for a series that's about a
The Ghost Whisperer. What was she doing?
No, it was actually for a series where she plays a housewife who falls on hard times and falls into prostitution.
Oh, when was that?
That was last year, I believe. So
that sounds like a winner.
Ago. So yeah, and it actually became a series. So good for Jennifer Love Hewitt.
There you go. All right. So here, one of the people that won for Best Actress, TV, Musical, or Comedy. So you had Zoe Deschanel for The New Girl. You had Julia Louis-Dreyfus for Veep. You had Tina Fey for 30 Rock. Mm-hmm. Amy Poehler for Parks and Rec. And then the winner was Lena Dunham for Girls.
I hate that you found out through the post-collegiate rumor mill, but I'm glad that you heard, because, you know, things with Beau were moving so quickly, and I just felt like eventually we were going to either see you or...
Beau?
What's his name? Yes.
And Beau is?
My lover.
Who's male?
Yes.
I didn't know.
That was Lena Dunham, her character in Girls, learning her college boyfriend is gay. So she's the it girl this year, right?
She really is. And that show is really just attracting a lot of buzz right now. I'm going to be honest with you. I was very surprised that she won over Amy Poehler. Not necessarily because Parks and Recreation is more widely viewed. I mean, I think, honestly, the viewership is probably similar when you look at audience numbers. But I think Amy Poehler had a really extraordinary storyline with Parks and Recreation last season with the election.
It was the levels of satire going on were brilliant.
It was just great. And if you think about that debate that she had with Bobby Newport, who was played by Paul Rudd, you know, I mean, this was there were levels of satire, and also there was a little, it spoke to voter anger. There's a level of idealism with her character that I believe should have been recognized. This is not to denigrate Lena Dunham. Congratulations to her. But I really question choosing her over Amy Poehler.
Well, when I look at the winners, I think to myself, are they just automatically opting for the premium prestige channels as opposed to maybe the best work being done in commercial TV?
Yeah, well, it's not just commercial TV, although, like I said, like you said, it is very telling that there are no broadcast network shows among the winners here, and fewer actually broadcast network programs among the nominees. So, you know, you do have to ask that question. I honestly think that it's more of a matter of what gets the most buzz. If you had a show on network that was getting an extraordinary amount of buzz last year, then it had a better chance. That's why you see Smash of in the comedy category, you know.
What's Smash? Some of the,
oh my goodness! So Smash is a show that
is the one with Marilyn Monroe. One?
Yes, it's the Marilyn Monroe musical Bombshell, and with Deborah Messing and Angelica Houston. Really great cast that just flopped in terms of the execution in its first season.
But they kept it around?
They kept it around because the NBC executives at the top really love the show. Bob Greenblatt came over to NBC from Showtime. He has been developing the show since then. This is his baby, and so that's why you're seeing it come back for a second season.
And I want to play another clip. So Best Actress TV Drama, this is the point here. Connie Britton in Nashville. Nashville is what, it's a network show? It's like ABC show or something?
Correct, yeah.
And
it's been on for half a season.
Soap opera singing in Nashville.
it is very soapy. I think that you know, I've got to say that even though there are soapy storylines, Connie Britton does an amazing job, you know, with her performance. She's one of those actresses who really has a way of hitting it out of the park, even if the material seems like it would be a bit subpar. Witness her work on American Horror Story. But yeah, I think that's one of those shows that, provided it does come back next season, that she'll get a little more notice there.
And then there's Glenn Close in Damages, Michelle Dockery in Downton Abbey, Juliana Margulies in The Good Wife, but the winner was Claire Danes, Homeland.
I have never been so sure and so wrong. And it's that fact that I still can't get my head around. It makes me unable to trust my own thoughts every time I think I see something clearly now. It just disappears.
It's Claire Danes. Damaged characters are all over television.
Oh, yes. And Claire Danes' character is, I mean, just particularly this season, legendarily damaged, so much so that you see, you know, Saturday Night Live has made jokes about Homeland. And then, of course, you had Anne Hathaway getting on and doing the Claire Danes parody. That said, I really do think that her performance has really taken what she can do with this role to the next level. I don't really question that win there. I think she really did a great job, even if the second season, in my opinion, was not as well executed as the first.
Who got snubbed in these Golden Globe Awards for television?
Oh, my goodness. Well, AMC is not having a good day today. I would say that the win of Homeland over the first half of the final season of Breaking Bad is questionable. Again, I do believe that's about buzz. I don't think that Homeland was a terrible show in the second season. I just don't think it was came off as well as it did in the first. But that the second half of the first half of the final season of Breaking Bad is just, if you watched it, it just kept on topping itself on many levels.
And I know you're not even telling me what happened.
I will not tell you. I can't believe you haven't kept up with this show.
I don't know what I've been doing.
Bryan Cranston did some amazing work. I really enjoy Damian Lewis's performance in Homeland, but put against Bryan Cranston's, I'm very, very surprised that he didn't get an individual Globe here.
Another damaged character in Bryan Cranston.
Yes, damaged in a different way.
Yeah, because he's sort of embraced his damage, perhaps that'd be a way to put it.
Oh, my goodness, yes. He has embraced it. He's put it on. It's his new skin. But yeah. I think that, you know, I think that it's difficult for a very straightforward character to get a whole lot of notice when you have shows like this. Shows like this. So it doesn't surprise me that you have your Homelands and, you know, Damian Lewis, Bryan Cranston, you know, even John Hamm, Don Draper being in the mix. That doesn't surprise me at all. Those damaged characters are interesting characters.
Yeah. You know, Melanie McFarland, I know you do this for a living, and I like to ask you this question because television does reflect our culture. I mean, I understand it's money and it's people trying to sell things and it's people trying to tell stories that will captivate us, but it exists within the time frame. So it reflects our culture as it goes on, hence Amy Poehler talking about politics this last year.
Correct.
Learning anything in TV about our culture from these awards, maybe, or from who was nominated?
Oh, if you're trying to learn anything about TV from the Golden Globes, I don't have anything for you. I just don't.
Fine.
I think that, you know, if you were to look at the winners, the things that they have in common is that they all have a level of politics to them. Even, you know, Don Cheadle, the work he's doing in House of Lies, I'm sorry. You know, all of that is it's corporate politics, you know. I think with Girls, there's been a lot of, if you really looked at the entirety of the Globes telecast last night, very, very positive in terms of representations of women. Amy Poehler and Tina Fey did an amazing job, and they really kept the audience on their side. Drawing blood. I mean, within the first 3 minutes of that telecast, they were making a very, very racy joke about James Cameron. I mean, not racy, but actually quite mean-spirited. But they kept the audience on their side, which is something that's really hard to do. It's something that Ricky Gervais was not able to do.
And they started by attacking Ricky Gervais. Always a good way to go.
Absolutely. But then you have, you know, the wins of both Girls and Lena Dunham. I mean, that's something that I don't think that the Hollywood Foreign Press Association intentionally thought, well, we're going to have two women hosting. Let's have a, you know, an praise of women kind of night. But I do think it goes along with the buzz of particularly the past few months post-election. There's been a lot of talk about women kind of reclaiming their place in politics and gender, you know, gender positive roles in culture. So I think that's one of the reasons that you're kind of seeing Lena Dunham held up as this figure, particularly for younger women.
Well, that's interesting considering the other best television series, musical or comedy nominated, Big Bang Theory. I don't know how women are portrayed in that show. Episodes, what is that?
So Episodes is Matt LeBlanc is Matt LeBlanc on Showtime.
That's right.
And it's about him coming over and coming back to television and doing an Americanized version of a UK show that is just horrible. And the British producers that have to deal with him and put together this show that is just a piece of trash that came over from this very highly regarded show in Britain.
And then you had Modern Family, Women in Modern Family.
Yeah, you know, I think the thing is, at some point you have to recognize that it is okay for women to be comic figures.
Yes.
And I do think that in terms of
Lucy would
particularly
agree with you on that.
Julie Bowen's character on Modern Family, she has some really great moments in that series. I think that Sofia Vergara also, you know, for all that people kind of want to nitpick about her performance, she really does have some great moments in that series. And back to Big Bang, I think that initially when it first started, they couldn't figure out how to make Penny look like something other than, you know, the cute blonde across the hall from the hyper-intelligent nerds. But Penny holds her own.
Yeah, she does.
She really does. And now they also have Bernadette on there. And they, you know, so they have female nerds and they also have just regular women being women. So, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily poke holes in.
So what does girls offer? As the winner, what does it offer women today? I mean, what are we seeing there?
I think you're seeing a lot of, I mean, basically what you're seeing is the early 20-something experience in the job market today. Presented as this very, you know, these characters are making these decisions that are not informed by having endless amounts of money. They're not fashionable. Lena Dunham's character in particular makes some very poor decisions. And a lot of them are very, you know, they're these girls who are both trying to figure themselves out and very sympathetic to each other. But it sometimes makes some very poor decisions that are born out of self-absorption. I think it's the fact that the series has a realism to it, and it does have that veneer of being on HBO, and you know, Lena Dunham getting this very this seven-figure book deal. You know, I mean, it's one of those shows that I think can be marketed on a number of levels.
But a self-aware writer,
yes,
bringing
very,
it to the
very self-aware, still trying to find her voice, and frankly, a job. So in an upcoming episode, you'll see that just what she'll do to find a job and how that goes completely sideways for her in her personal life.
So you mentioned Don Cheadle, movie star working in TV.
Yes.
Jeff Daniels, The Newsroom. He was also nominated for his, though he didn't win.
Right.
Movies on TV. TV is the place a lot of people are finding. I know we talked about this already, but
yeah, that's true.
People are finding great roles that they can really sink their teeth into.
Yes, and spread over a long period of time. So there are layers of development, there are changes and evolution that they can embark upon with a character that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do in a 2-hour movie.
Hey, what happened to Downton Abbey? I know Maggie Smith won for Best Supporting Actress, but she has to win.
Yes, and that's a very interesting category. Those supporting actors and actresses really kind of are in an interesting position with the Globes, because that's a category where you have actors in dramas going up against actors in comedies and TV movies and miniseries. So
they just ran out of they didn't want to have too many categories and just bunched them all together.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's essentially since 1980. In 1970, the category was just had supporting roles in comedies going up against supporting roles in dramas, which of course made sure that comedies got the short straw. Usually. But then in 1980, they added the miniseries and movies roles into those categories. So now you have all of these disparate performances shoved together and all these actors and actresses hoping for the best. So, you know, of course you say, of course, Maggie Smith's going to get it for Downton Abbey. But then you look at who else she's up against. She's up against Hayden Panettiere in Nashville. Archie Punjabi for The Good Wife, who I think probably had her best chance of going up and maybe besting Maggie Smith. But come on, let's be real. That wasn't going to happen. You know, Sarah Paulson, who did an amazing job in Game Change, and then Sofia Vergara. But then you have on the actor's side, I won't go through all of them, but you have Eric Stonestreet and Max Greenfield praying for a Globe when they're going up against Ed Harris in Game Change and Manny Patinkin for Homeland.
More movie stars working in television.
Right.
I think if I were a TV actor, I'd be kind of mad at all those guys.
Yeah.
And gals.
But I think, you know, this is one of those situations where Max Greenfield is getting noticed because he does a great job as Schmidt on New Girl. But how is he going to be, how can he expect to get a Globe when he's going up against Ed Harris in one of the most talked about and critically acclaimed HBO films of the year?
All right. So leave me with, since I get to have you here and as your job as TV editor, you have to know this stuff. Leave me with something that we should take a look at coming up in a TV series, something that you've enjoyed that you think people haven't seen enough of and might want to tell us to watch.
Wow. I've talked about The Americans coming up.
Oh, yeah.
That's at the end of the month. I really do think people should check that out. The very interesting news that came out of the recent Television Critics Association press tour is that Ray Donovan is the new Showtime series that's going to be premiering in June. And to ensure that the most people watch it, they are bringing back Dexter early. Dexter usually premieres in September, but now if you want to watch the next season of Dexter, you won't have to wait as long. It's going to be in June.
There's going to be another season of Dexter?
Yeah, there's going to be another season of Dexter. They're trying to decide if they want another season after that, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
And how many people does that guy have to murder?
Well, the thing that makes it very interesting is that Dexter coming back means that it's going to premiere around the same time and share the same time slot as likely Breaking Bad and True Blood. So Sunday nights are going to get really interesting really quickly in the summertime.
Thank goodness for DVRs.
That's right.
Melanie McFarland is the TV editor at IMDb. She was also the TV gal at the Seattle PI for 5 years and has been reporting on this excellent medium for a long time. I appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for
having
me.
Let's do it again.
Oh, definitely.
Let's go out with little Julianne Moore from a TV show that won Game Change.
I think the United States has always maintained a great relationship with the Queen, and John McCain will continue to have an open dialogue with her.
Governor, the Queen is not the head of government in England. She's the head of state.
Well, then who's the head of government?
The Prime Minister.
A clip from the TV show Game Change on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:45. 36 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. It's supposed to be cloudy for the rest of the day, and we don't expect to get any warmer than it is right now. Overnight, clouds, a low of 31, and tomorrow, Tuesday, some morning fog, otherwise mostly cloudy again with a predicted high of 37.
Support for KUOW comes from the Cornell Queens Executive MBA program, designed for mid-career managers and professionals, offering weekend classes in Seattle. Local admissions events January 17th and 19th. Information and event registration at cornellseattle.com.
We travel to Indonesia next time on PRI's The World and meet a musician some call the Bob Dylan of Jakarta. His name is Iwan Falls. In a decades-long career, he's been a protest singer, a balladeer, a pop star, and an inspiration for Indonesia's reform movement. His music next time on The World.
Sabar, 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 dan tunggu. Itu jawab.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Community Power Works, a City of Seattle program to help homeowners reduce energy use by connecting them with approved contractors and access to rebates and financing. More on customized home energy upgrades at communitypowerworks.org.
10:46. Next hour, football and head injuries. Can the NFL make a dangerous game safer? We'll take that up in about 25 minutes.
But first, football and what happened with the Seahawks yesterday. We're going to talk to Tim Booth from the AP in a moment, but we're in the Cal Zone now. That's what we're calling our sports zone, the Cal Zone, because it's a lot of juicy and there's a lot of pieces of meat. So I know you watched this football game. What happened? What do you make of it? What does it mean for our city? Katie Sewell, who's the producer of the show, for some reason that one can only guess, loves the football.
I do.
And you watched this game. What happened? Why did they lose?
This game, before I came in here, I was looking at pictures of the final moments, and I was still having a heart attack.
Well, that's why this is why you said we should ask you to call at 206-543-5869 or 1-800-289-5869. Yes, in the Cal Zone, we would like you to weigh in.
Yes, please tell us your reflections on what happened. It was a heart stopper of a game yesterday because, you know, it was an embarrassing first half, I think, in my opinion, knowing what this team can do. And then we're, you know, completely shut out in the first half of the game. And then after that, you know, as you're thinking about turning it off, oh, we're not going to, this is the end, it's over. And then all of a sudden they start to come back like the miracle team that they've been all season. And oh my gosh! I mean, were people just jumping up and down on the couch? Because I was screaming at the television.
You quoted Andy Hurst as saying, you know, we can't settle for, well, they made it to the end because, you know what, he wanted them to win. You can't just be, but that's Seattle. So I asked Tim Booth, who's the Seattle-based sports writer for AP, what does this mean for Seattle?
it basically... It sure felt like it defined kind of the sports history here. To fall behind the way they did, to kind of mount this kind of incredible comeback in the fourth quarter, and then give it away in the final 30 seconds. You look at the past history of teams here, whether it was the 2005 Seahawks team that finally reached the Super Bowl and then kind of fell short there. You can go back to the 96 Sonics that reached the finals and just happened to run into Michael Jordan in the finals, or the 2001 Mariners, who set the record for most wins in a season and then have to face Roger Clemens and the Yankees in the playoffs. It just seems like this, whenever this region gets a really good team, a good product to rally around, to throw their support behind, they might be the best team out there, but when it comes to, you know, playoff matchups or what have you, something gets in the way of actually seeing it all the way through to a championship. So the game yesterday is kind of, I guess, encapsulated the struggle and the inner turmoil that Seattle sports fans have felt for quite a long time.
Now, Tim Booth, going into the game, you wrote that it was going to come down to Seahawks defense, pressure on Matt Ryan. Did that arise?
No, and that was, to me, the two biggest keys from yesterday as to why Atlanta was so good offensively was the fact that Seattle couldn't get a pass rush on Matt Ryan, and the Seahawks run defense had lapsed at times during the second half of the season. They were so good early in the season, and then as the year kind of progressed, you saw more chinks in what their run defense was able to do. And that was evident yesterday. Atlanta was not a very good team running the football coming into the game. And for them to have a season high in yards rushing, whether it was Michael Turner or Jacquizz Rodgers running the ball, was really that allowed them to control possession more. It allowed them to keep their offense on the field more, kind of wore down the Seahawks defense there for a while, especially in the first half, and really set the tone for the game to where Seattle had to pay attention to what Atlanta was doing in the run game and not completely focusing on all those weapons they had throwing the ball to Tony Gonzalez or Roddy White or Julio Jones.
It really is interesting to watch a game and realize how critical each individual is to their position. So they didn't have Chris Clemens. Would he have made a difference?
Yes, absolutely. Bruce, I think Bruce Irvin will be really good eventually. He's got so much speed, and it's so rare to find in that position as a defensive end that eventually he'll either figure out what he needs to do to be and become very, very successful, or he's going to be kind of a bust. And I think it's kind of one of those two things. Yesterday was a perfect example of him not yet quite having the array of moves and skills that you need as a defensive end. He's still got the great speed, but he struggled yesterday whenever he tried to do a kind of a bull rush or a power rush because he's undersized as compared to a lot of offensive linemen. Most of the season he was going up against right tackles, which are kind of typically the lesser of the two tackles on the offensive line. And yesterday he was going up against left tackles, there's a reason left tackles are paid more than anybody else in any other interior lineman in football, because their job is to protect the backside of the quarterback. So, Chris Clemens, I think people undervalued how good he was, both as a pass rusher, but also in helping to stop the run. And I think that was really evident yesterday, just how much value he has for this team.
He's coming back?
Yeah, he'll be back. He signed a new contract this past offseason, a 3-year deal. And so as long as his recovery from his knee surgery, which hasn't happened yet, goes well, he should be back maybe training camp. But if the timeline works right, he should be back by the start of next season.
Tim Booth is Seattle-based sports writer for the Associated Press. He's at Twitter by Tim Booth. So the Seahawks depend on Marshawn Lynch. He had 2 fumbles in the playoffs. They can't really run a successful game if they just have one person that they turn to, can they? Because he gets beat up hard.
Yeah, I mean, Marshawn, part of it was he had a foot sprain that he suffered last week in Washington, and it didn't seem like yesterday he had the same kind of explosiveness coming off the ball. It seemed like that foot was bothering him a little bit. I think Atlanta did a really good job with their run defense yesterday. That you know, they essentially put the game on the shoulders of Russell Wilson and said, okay, we're not gonna let Marshawn Lynch beat us. We're gonna make Russell Wilson beat us. We're gonna make this rookie on the road in the playoffs beat us, and he almost did it. So, you know, I think going forward, their plans began the season with they drafted Robert Turbin with the idea that he would be someone that could come in and spell Marshawn and give him a little bit more rest so he wasn't so beat up later in the season. I think we're going to see more of that next year, kind of spotting Turbin in a little bit more. And also, I think the way that Seattle's offense evolved and expanded during the season to where they were able to use Russell Wilson as more of a running threat, I think we'll see some more of that earlier next season to where Marshawn isn't carrying too much of a load early in the year and then feeling the effects of that as the season wears on.
And silver linings, among other things, Russell Wilson, pretty amazing rookie of the year.
I don't think he'll win rookie of the year.
He won't get it.
If rookie of the year included playoffs, I think he would have a chance to win it. But the rookie of the year voting only takes into account what you did in the regular season. What a lot of people consider a flaw in the voting process, but if you took into account the playoffs, I think he'd have a really good shot of winning it. What he did in those two playoff games was pretty remarkable, especially you know when you consider his lack of experience at this level. You know his performance. Yesterday was the most passing yards ever by a rookie in a playoff game. It was kind of to put it in perspective of how good it was. It was tied for the 20th all time for most passing yards in any playoff game in NFL history. Kind of just his poise and his composure, nothing felt rushed yesterday as they were kind of putting together this comeback down 20 in the fourth quarter. Everything he did felt like it was in rhythm. It was not like he was in this kind of just state of hurry and where things can get frantic and get kind of out of your control. He was always just poised and calm. It's kind of one of the remarkable things you've seen throughout this season of his progression. It's just he stays very calm and very poised in all these situations. You know, it's the great mystery in the NFL is who is going to be the leader of your team at the most important position. And it's something a lot of teams search for yearly and struggle to find yearly is who's going to be that quarterback and who can lead your team for a long time. And frankly, the Seahawks, they have their answer for the next five years, maybe 10 years. As long as he can stay healthy and continue to show this kind of amazing progression that he did this year.
They have their answer. That's Tim Booth, Seattle-based sports writer for the Associated Press. Jonathan writes, compared to how well they played the second half, such talent and execution holds enormous promise. Tune in next year. These are not the Mariners. That's what Jonathan says. And Gerald writes, it was a lousy field in Washington, D.C. that cost the Seahawks the game. Clemens was hurt, according to two sports writers, because of that field. Those last two passes of Ryan might have been stopped or rushes or intercepted by Clemens. Oh, well. Coulda, shoulda, woulda. Maybe next year.
And now, the sound of the day.
That is the sound of winter for weekday listener Christina. She lives in an old rambling home in Bellevue, a Rambler built in 1949. It still has the original oil furnace that heats up the house. And that's the sound that the furnace makes as it's burning the oil. Wow, I think some birds are getting burned in there too. That's a very cool sound. Christina says that while it's running, she can see the flame and hear the oil running, almost as if they had a faucet running in the house all the time. She says the noise makes her very conscious about using oil. So does the price. Burning oil isn't cheap either. Well, what sounds make you conscious of the world around you or the costs that you're incurring? Send us sound of the day, weekday at kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. Bernard Udatz, our engineer. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Magano, Amin Al-Sadi, Alexander Garrettin, Danielle Anthony Goodwin, our interns. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. Have a good day.
/10:59 Former President George H.W. Bush has been released from the hospital in Houston after several weeks being treated for bronchitis and other health issues. More in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hedvig and the Angry Inch, a co-production with Balogun Theater starring Jarek Hoffer, live at the Moore Theater January 15th through the 27th. Tickets available now at stgpresents.org.
50 years ago, George Wallace gave his first inaugural address as governor of Alabama, and he uttered these infamous words.
Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
Remembering one of the most notorious speeches in American history, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which begins at 3 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evergreen State College in Olympia, announcing their annual open house.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.